Hello, and welcome to the BA Brew. I'm Debbie.
And I'm Donald.
And I'm Pete.
And today, we're going to discuss the use and impact of artificial intelligence, AI. What are the opportunities and benefits offered by AI? And where are there risks that maybe should cause us concern, particularly those of us working in the change and technology industry? And I'm so pleased that we have Donald Farmer joining us today as one of the foremost thinkers and researchers and presenters in this particular area. So thank you, Donald, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. I thought we would come to you first, and I'm sure Pete will want to join the conversation at some point, but I'd be really interested in knowing, Donald, where do you think the key benefits lie that AI offers to businesses, to technologists, you know, in the world?
Well, it's a super interesting question, because even as we were talking about it, AI is developing. You know, we're recording this podcast, and I guarantee even if you broadcast it tomorrow, AI will have moved on. And there'll be some new story about some new capability of what it's doing. So let's not try to prognosticate too much. But I would say this, that the fundamental capability of AI for business is that it is automation. Is ultimately it enables smart systems to autonomously do things which previously needed human activity, human input to do it. So there's lots of things that we do in business, which is pretty repetitive. You know this from your daily work. I know it from my daily work, and I'm self-employed. There are, you know, things that I do that are repetitive. There are things that I do that are, and then because they're repetitive, maybe tedious is too strong a word, but they're just repetitive work. When you find that a human being is doing something that is, you know, continuously repetitive, that has the same inputs, the same outputs, it's pretty much predictable, then those are areas where AI can take on the role. And they can it can take on the role with a flexibility that traditional systems couldn't take on. So it's not as rigid as a traditional system. It's not as creative as a human being, but it's not as rigid as a traditional system. But it's also very efficient. It can do these things very quickly. So all sorts of processes which can be automated, that's really the difference that it's going to make. We hear all sorts of things about the excitement of Gen AI and how good it is at writing or creating images or all those sort of things. But really the fundamental difference is its ability to automate processes that for human beings are repetitive and tedious.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because one of the areas that your team have worked in, Pete, is looking at voice generation and those sorts of tasks that are very time consuming. So what's your take on this?
Well, if I could just build on what Donald said there, you know, it's automating, but it's also automating in a smarter way, if that makes sense. Because, I mean, for example, we're using text-to-speech algorithms. They've been around for a long time, but they used to be very robotic, a bit like, I don't know whether anyone can remember Microsoft SAM a few years ago. But now they're much closer to emulating the human voice. And in fact, for a long time, we didn't use them for the reason that they were too obviously generated. Now, you know, the team are almost coming up with a different tool every week. They're saying, "Oh, let's have a look at this one because it does it even better. It's got even better voices." So I think, you know, it's that automating things that save us time. And let's face it, you know, in our team, that really does save us time, because recording and editing and re-recording is actually a time-consuming process, and it has saved us significant amounts of time. But it's also upped our game, I think, because the quality of what we produce is so much better without a huge investment in an audio suite, you know, and a full-blown recording studio in order to do those audio.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I'd be interested, Donald, in your take on one of the things that I perceive is that different industries need to make different usage of different elements of AI. You know, so in our particular business and in one part of it, that's a really important element. It may be of no importance whatsoever to somebody working in a different industry. And I just wonder if you've encountered that, the different areas of work, different industries have different requirements for AI.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a good example of this is that there are verticals in which AI can be extremely impactful. And I think we're going to see, for example, in the industry in the media industry, we'll see a huge impact of AI because the ability to generate images, ability to generate text, the ability to generate video, and a lot of what is done today in media is actually fairly repetitive. And AI will make a huge, huge difference there. It's going to be enormous. On the other hand, we have applications of AI which will affect every industry, and those are more horizontal applications. And a really good example of this that I've been working on very recently was with a company that does automated screening interviews for hiring. Not interviews, but screening interviews. So they put up, job postings. This is in the US. They'll put up job postings. They may get 1,000 applicants, may get 2,000 applicants for some of these jobs. And somebody's got to go through all the resumes and probably whittle that down to, today would whittle it down to maybe like even just 400 or 500 applicants. But doing the phone screening with 400 or 500 applicants, that's a huge amount of time. It's a huge amount of human effort. Very, very expensive. And in fact, the AI can do it when all you're doing is actually calling somebody up, checking their resume, making sure they're at the right phone number, the right address, checking their details, and doing that, and not making a judgment about them at that point, just basically doing the phone screening in order to filter people out for the interview that will be conducted by human beings. If each one of these calls takes even 15 minutes, and you're talking about doing 400 of them, that's a huge amount of time, 100 hours of time that you're saving. That's like 3 weeks of work for somebody. So that's a tremendous cost saving. And that's something which can be applied across almost any industry. So we have the vertical applications, we have horizontal applications. We will all be affected by horizontal applications. Some of us will be affected by the vertical applications, and they'll be quite dramatic in the industries that they do affect.
Yes, and it's interesting that you mentioned the media and that whole industry. One of the things that Pete and I are involved in, and well, you're involved in certainly as a presenter, is in presenting and writing. And of course, what you come into then is the whole area around intellectual property, and sometimes intellectual property, not just of what you've presented and written, but of your image. And so, where we're veering there then is to some of the risks that are going to be encountered and some of the difficulties, I think. I mean, I don't know, Pete, if you've thought at all about that particular.
Well, yes, very much so. I remember back to our very first AI brew, and it was about 10 months ago, so we weren't exactly right up on the cutting edge at the time because AI has been around for many, many years, but certainly it was becoming much more popular at that stage. And we thought it would be really good to do one of these BA brews hosted by the AI. So we got an AI avatar, and we did the text to speech, and we were asking questions of GPT, Chat GPT at the time, and then sort of feeding them in. I mean, there was a bit of jiggery pokery going on behind the scenes, as I'm sure you can imagine, Donald. But we asked it some interesting questions, and one of the questions that we asked it, which was very pertinent to our world, of course, is, does a BA need to be human? Because there's a lot of fear around, oh, am I going to lose my job? Is AI going to take over the world and we're all suddenly going to become redundant? And the interesting response was, yes, it does need to be a human because there are certain skills that are required in business analysis that AI hasn't perfected or even developed to any extent at this stage. And I think, going back to your conference presentation, your keynote at the BA conference last year, you were talking about certain things that humans are still going to need to be able to do, and kind of making the best of both worlds, really. Getting an AI to get involved in what it's good at, but also maximizing what humans are good at that AI really isn't good at or can't do at all.
This is very, very important. We really need to take on board the fact that AI will take on a huge number of tasks that human beings can do. And then we actually need to think about two things, I think. One is, what is it that human beings can do uniquely that AI cannot? And we're going to find that space shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, but there will be areas where human beings have an advantage, or where human beings are uniquely capable of doing it compared to AI. That's one thing. But the other thing, which I think is often overlooked in this conversation, is, what are the things that we want human beings to do? Not necessarily that the AI can't do, but that we would prefer a human being to do. And that's somewhat different. I often say that AI will take jobs, but it'll take the jobs that are done by people we don't care about. Not the jobs we don't care about, but if we don't care about the people. I was in San Diego once. I was visiting the designer Don Norman, who has written many famous books on design, the Design of Everyday Things, for example, one of his famous books. And I was visiting him, and on a whiteboard in his office, he had a little cryptic saying. It said, "A car is an accessory to the smartphone." And I said, "Oh, what does that mean, you know?" And he said, "Well, how did you get here?" "Well, I flew from Seattle. I took an Uber to the university." He said, "You took an Uber. You came by phone." I said, "Well, no, I came by car." "You know, it's a car." He said, "No, you came by phone. It's the phone that got you here." And then he drilled into this question of, "What did you speak to the driver about?" I said, "Well, I didn't. I was on the phone to my office while I was at work." He said, "So the driver could easily have been a robot. The driver could easily have been an autonomous vehicle. You wouldn't have cared." And he's absolutely right. I didn't care about the driver. The driver, to me, was just a functionary to get me to his office. Ever since then, I always make a point of speaking to my Uber drivers, speaking to my taxi drivers, asking them about their life, their job, this sort of thing, because I want to be interested in them as human beings. If we are not interested in people as human beings, AI can do it. So it's actually not a question of the technology, it's a question of us. We need to be more interested and more engaged in the human element. And if we're not, then AI will do it.
And that's really interesting because coming back to the idea of maybe some of the risks posed, I always think it's not so much that AI can do it, it's should we want it to do it? You know, should we want that? And that takes you into whole other areas because if we come back to the point around creativity, there are things that ChatGPT could generate for us. And somebody actually asked me last week about exam questions. Okay. But the point is, do we want them? Do we want it to? You know, do we want them generated? Is there something around that lateral thinking, creative thinking that actually we want when we're assessing people or evaluating something? And so, you know, it's that question. It's not just can it do it, it should it do it for me. And that's really what we have to think about.
Yes, because
Absolutely.
there's no doubt. I mean, AI can create unique works of art and can create unique music, but that sort of spoils the whole, you know, creative world, doesn't it, really? Because the key things about creativity is not the mechanics of how do you actually do it. It's all of the emotion and the feeling that goes into the art that is a sort of innately human thing. So yes, you know, you see all of these articles, oh, you know, there's AI that can do this, there's AI that can do that, but actually most people probably don't really want AI to do that. And interestingly, you said, Donald, about we're not interested in the people in certain situations. Well, actually, we're not really interested in the AI in certain situations either. So I think it cuts both ways,
Exactly.
doesn't it?
And we have to be careful about this, that we appreciate the human element. I live in Seattle. I used to live in Scotland, and of course, that's where I was brought up, famously dark, rainy country. And I moved to Seattle, which is a dark, rainy part of the United States, famously dark and rainy. And yet in both Scotland and Seattle, I have seen people lining up outside an ATM machine in the rain while the bank was still open next door. They could have walked into the bank, but they'd rather stand in the rain and deal with a machine than they would go into the bank and see the teller. I don't know why, but this is like human nature, or at least it's an aspect of nature. People use the automated checkouts at the supermarket rather than going to, rather than going through the manual one. If we don't care about that human element in our life, if we don't care about that human element in our work, then it'll atrophy because we're not using it. And I don't think of it. I want to be careful about this. I don't think of this as AI somehow being a negative force in our life. I think of it as being the atrophy of our human content of our lives. And that's up to us. That's not the AI's mm-hmm. issue. This is our issue. If we allow the human element to atrophy, that is our doing.
Yes, yeah, very interesting. And I want to sort of come on to a subject that you touched on in your, well, you didn't just touch on, you talked about it in your keynote at the Business Change and Transformation Conference earlier this year, which is, as Pete knows, one of my soapboxes, which is to do with inherent bias in some of the generative AI.
Yeah.
Because you gave a fabulous example.
How long have we got?
He's not starting because we've got somebody else to have this soapbox, not just me. So, yeah, to you, Donald, on that one.
Well, so I'm going to start with what I think is an important point to make that again, is often overlooked, which is that bias is not necessarily bad. Very often we use the word bias to mean bad bias. Oh, that algorithm is biased. And we mean that as a criticism. Mm-hmm. All algorithms are biased. In fact, mm-hmm. the purpose of an algorithm is to automate bias. Let me give you an example mm-hmm. of this. If you have an algorithm which sets car insurance rates, and you want it to be biased, you want it to be biased mm-hmm. against bad drivers. That's mm-hmm. that's a form of bias. You don't want it to give everybody the same rate. The bad driver, they get a higher rate. So that's a form of bias. Do we want it to be biased against women or ethnic minorities? No, we don't. But it's another form of bias. So what we have to be very careful about is identifying and articulating the types of bias that are possible and the types of bias we want and the types of bias we don't want. And once we can actually do that and be articulate about these biases, then we can test for them. And it becomes a regular part of the testing process, just in the same way as you would test for accuracy, you would test for scalability, you test for security, you test for performance, mm-hmm. you test for security. All those things that you test for in systems, now you can test for bias. But in order to create those tests and run them, whether they're software tests or manual tests, you have to be articulate about what you want and what you don't want. So when we talk about bias, let's be clear that we're talking about negative biases. But once I put it in that context, that everything is biased and it's a question of identifying what we want and don't want, now you can see that the task changes a bit. It's not about how do we create a system which is unbiased. It's actually about how do we test for bias? How do we identify and test for bias? That's a very different problem. Luckily, it's a much easier problem than trying to create an unbiased system. Try to create a system where we can test for bias and then tune it. But we have to be articulate about our biases if we're going to do that.
That's really interesting, because I also see bias conflict, as I call it, which is where you understand the bias one group of stakeholders, one perspective might accept. Mm. And that can be in conflict with the bias that another group of stakeholders' perspective finds acceptable. And the big and obvious one is in a retail environment. So, you know, online retailers with algorithms that accept all sorts of nonsense, and then you require the human element to actually filter through something that you'd really prefer not to have to filter through. And then you also get the, you know, outlets, the automated checkout outlets in supermarkets and stores and that, where you can see there is that conflict between making it a good experience for the customer, but making sure they don't get away with anything. And so you've got conflicts then within algorithms. And I find that quite interesting. I find it very annoying, but I also find it very interesting, because you're right. You then, as a business analyst and from a BA perspective, I'm thinking, well, actually, if I was an analyst, I would want to analyze where I wanted, you know, where the balance was between those two in order to minimize that conflict. But I don't know if that's actually something we do very much in the analytical phases.
We don't. And I think, I'm sorry,
No, carry on.
Well, I was going to say, I think one of the things that we overlook in business analysis, even business analysts overlook this, is the sheer scale of what's possible and the fact that our processes change as they get into different as they get into different scales. There's a sort of it's not as if, Amazon is just a really big corner shop. It actually operates in a completely different way. Because it needs to, and because it can, and because it needs to. So it's not a linear scale where things just go, bigger and bigger and bigger, and faster and faster and faster, and more automation. At some point, there's you're in a different kind of business, different kind of operation. And I think the checkout that you mentioned is a really, really interesting one. People can misscan things. They can put in the wrong codes. They can, take chanterelle mushrooms and pass them off as ordinary mushrooms, and then something that would cost £20 a pound suddenly costs £2 a pound or something like that, and they can sneak away with that, or at least they think they can. And of course, there are people who might get caught doing that, and there's a certain amount of security. But what people forget is that the reason supermarkets can do this at all is because they factored in those losses, because they're talking about doing this at enormous scale. This is not like a corner shop, your corner grocer, where if somebody sneaks off with the chanterelles, that's they've lost money out of their pocket, and it's serious money as a proportion of their business. What we're talking about is a business that is processing hundreds, billions of transactions in a day, and therefore their level of risk enables them to have a process which is much more automation, but it has a higher level of kind of risk in it. Because of the scale they're operating at. And so I think as business analysts, there's a kind of point at which you have to understand not just is automation possible, but does that actually change with the scale of our operations?
Absolutely. And I think also you have to understand commerce in a lot of these situations. And that requires the business analyst to really have commercial understanding because you can't make life perfect. You do have these conflicts. And in order to navigate them, you've got to have a commercial understanding a lot of the time and understand that balance and that risk level, et cetera, et cetera. But it's to me, it's fascinating because it pulls the whole thing together then that actually where, what are we trying to achieve? Why are we doing this? And what are the different perspectives on it becomes incredibly important. So yeah, that's very interesting. Very interesting. Pete, have you got anything you'd like to add on that?
Yeah, I should try and do this without coffee, and unfortunately, I seem to have developed a bit of a cough. I mean, one of the things that immediately sort of sparked for me when Donald was explaining this idea of bias and testing for bias is that sort of changes a little bit our understanding of requirements, doesn't it? Or at least extends it. Because there are some new types of requirements here that we need to think about in terms of AI specific systems, and accuracy, maybe the provenance of information, bias, et cetera, et cetera. So really, we need to be able to define a new set of requirement types to try and tie down, well, what are the parameters here? What is acceptable? What's not acceptable? And that can sort of drive then the testing, as you said, Donald, because I mean, one of the things about testing is, yes, there are lots of different ways of doing it, but is it actually testing the right thing? And are we happy? Is there sufficient understanding of the results that give us a sense of security, really, that the solution is not going to be having adverse by I can't get my words out today, byproducts, if you like, or adverse effects haven't preempted.
So that's a really interesting and very important point. The emergent properties of these automated systems, the adverse effect that you didn't expect, you automate them and suddenly there's a form of, sometimes it's a form of bias that occurs, and sometimes It's just a kind of unexpected side effect of that. I mean, a good example of that is, I think if we're talking about retail, I think that's a really good one. People with and I don't know how it is in the UK, but I've seen in the US that people will the number of items in a basket is lower when people have to scan them themselves. And then they choose the items that are easiest to scan. And so, for example, if they're going to the produce section to buy fruit and vegetables, they're going to buy more packaged fruit and vegetables, which have got a barcode on them, which is easier to scan, rather than buying loose items, which have to be kind of weighed and things like that. Now, of course, the supermarket can adjust for that, but this is very important. The behavior of the consumer is changed by the system. The automation of the system is not just something which enables the consumer to carry on doing the same thing. The system itself has an effect. So you have this loop, and this is something I was talking about a bit in the keynotes that I was giving, that there's this looping effect. Today, we're in this a system where AI is being brought into human systems and is changing our business. What we need to bear in mind is that as that develops, our business will change the AI. So we are automating the system today as it is. The business will change because it is automated, and that, just simply commercially, will change the demands that are made of future AI systems. So when I say we don't really know where we're going to go in the future, and we don't want to prognosticate too much, it's because of that. It's because businesses will change as a reflection of AI, but AI will then change to better support those models of the business, and things will loop. And what we don't really know at this point is how the behavior of people will change in relation to AI. We're already seeing there's a very funny joke I've seen on the internet about the manager who says, I used AI to turn this one bullet point into an entire email, and somebody sitting at the other end saying, I used AI to turn this email into one bullet point. So how good is it? The process, the AI becomes in the process and starts kind of looping in this way. And we just don't know what's going to happen, but it's absolutely fascinating.
I think that's exactly it, and I think that's a lovely point to wrap this up, actually, because there are emergent properties from these changes, from these systems, and we might be able to maybe predict some. We may be able to look at research and trends to predict a bit of the future. But people are unpredictable and life is unpredictable.
They really
So
are.
who knows where it might go. But thank
Exactly
you
so.
ever so much, Donald, for joining us. That was absolutely fascinating. And thank you, Pete, for joining on this BA Brew as well. It's been
My pleasure.
really good to talk to you both. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And we could have gone on a lot longer, I think.
We certainly could,
So
couldn't we?
thank you also to our
Thank
audience
you
for
very
watching
much.
this episode of BA Brew, and I really hope you got something out of it. I certainly did. And if anybody out there has any ideas from watching this or from watching any of the other episodes of anything else we might discuss in future episodes, then please do contact us on babrew@assistkd.com. And as always, please like, share, and subscribe. Thanks very much.